This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Since 2011, the Performance Biennial in New York City, they asked me to do a radio play, actually, in WNYC's green room, which had a piano in it. And somehow in the back of my mind, I'd been thinking of pianos. And so when they told me that that was available in this room, I instantly knew that that was something I wanted to work with. And not writing a piece for a piano, but I was very interested in this idea of doing live electronic processing on the piano. And so I started looking for a composer's music that would be interesting to work with. And I went down a deep wormhole about Philippa Duke Schuyler, George F. Schuyler's daughter, biracial piano prodigy from New York City. She died in a freak helicopter accident. Anyhow, you know, ultimately it wasn't productive, but what came out of it was that my friend, Sharifa Rhodes Pitts, she was like, well, if you're interested in this sort of space of like tragic black piano players who died young in New York City, you should check out this guy, Eastman. And she had heard about him from friends of hers in Cape Town who have a jazz cafe, and that was this route that we took. And like many people, I'd heard him, you know, following her recommendation, my mind was blown, you know, because I'd heard so much, you know, the 70s in New York, they're so mythologized, you know, and they're so well documented in many ways, or one thinks. And then you get a character who is touching in all these different scenes. He's playing with Arthur Russell, you know, he's hanging out with, you know, Morton Feldman and pissing off John Cage and really moving around. And yet, in terms of the historical record, I think Kyle's book is the only physical book I've seen with his name in it to date. You know, that's about to change soon. And so I was really struck, and I was instantly like, okay, this is really, really rich material to work with and engage with. And I was looking at the sort of, you know, the fragility or the fragmented nature of his own documentation. I was listening to some of the recordings, and I was excited by the very interesting and very performative contentiousness of his titles, like Evil Nigger, Nigger Faggot, all these things which are, there's a restlessness and an unruliness to it which felt very alive. And so the initial part of the Julius Eastman Memorial Dinner was having two pianists perform Eastman works while I'm doing live electronic processing. And, you know, riffing off his ideas of multiples, and also trying to have my intervention being a bit more like a DJ, as sort of troubling the waters between what he's written, what the pianists are expressing, and then what's going on in my zone. And so this is the initial performa piece. Sharif is reading, and this was just 10 minutes, but we were all very excited by that afterwards, and so I ended up expanding it for a new evening-length piece, which is the Julius Eastman Memorial Dinner, which debuted in 2013. And we've been sort of touring it around since then. I'm working with the core members of the group are Emily Manzo on the left and David Friend on the right and vocalist Aruj Aftab. And I'm just going to play 2 or 3 minutes from a show we did in Austin last year that will let you sort of... This is us playing an excerpt of Gay Gorilla, and you can hear what on my sort of interventions or collaborations on top of it. Yeah, maybe a little. Actually, I got it. Thank you. And so with this, let's go over, this is us playing it, banging a can recently. But so with the sort of sonic intervention goes something like that. You know, I'm taking a live microphone feed off each piano. They're doing sort of very faithful, very, very beautiful renditions of the Eastman pieces, and then I'm improvising and along with that. And sometimes I'm doing very minimal effects, and then sometimes I'm sort of surging to go over the music and playing with that flow throughout. But as I was sort of embarking on this piece, you know, I was, of course, very aware of, you know, after the initial shock of what I saw as Eastman's absence from the sort of broader historical record, I started thinking about how my work with would make him more visible, in a sense. And so I started thinking of the broader aspects around that. You know, there's something very, is a very easy way to romanticize the sort of tragic black genius. You know, you've got the sort of the myth and the talented tense on the one side, then you've got the myth of black incompetence on the other, and you've got drug addiction, and it's all very, you know, it's, it there's a way in which it can play out in sort of the most facile of ways. And so I know I knew I wanted to step away from that. And then the more I thought about Eastman's life, the more I thought about how, in a way, his story isn't exceptional. It's so common that musicians come out, try their best, they make some beautiful noise, and then they're forgotten. And then they're swallowed up by one thing or another, and then we don't hear about them. You know, this surge of memory might be more more surprising than anything else in his life. But with that in mind, you know, to try and, like, how can I have how can I work with his history in a way which honors that trickster spirit and doesn't reinforce any of these too easy narratives? And so that led me to start thinking about ways in which I could to trouble that reading. And so I was like, well, how has precariousness changed for New York City people today? You know, back then, maybe it was like, yes, he's strung out, he's been evicted, he's living in Tompkins Square Park. And I was like, but the entire situation has changed. Now, maybe your situation is you went to an undergrad, you have debt, you're temping somewhere in a corporate institution, and it's a whole different vision. And so what I wanted to do with Eastman Dinner was, on the one hand, I was like, I'm not just going to play his songs with my sounds interpenetrating them. I was like, let's find a way to bring in his story so that people who come to it, maybe being familiar with my work but don't know Eastman, can get enough biographical detail to have some weight, but also challenge that. And so that structure ended up being, we play Evil Nigger to begin. And one of the great things about the Eastman pieces is, even at their titles, at their most provocative, you know, Evil Nigger, then it's 25 minutes of incredibly beautiful, incredibly moving, muscular, gentle, hypnotic, immersive sounds. So we play Evil Nigger, and then what happens is there's a loud phone call, you know, after this very live music, and I pick up the phone, and it shifts into this radio play mode, where basically the structure is that I'm being interviewed for a position as a Julius Eastman impersonator. And so I was thinking about Colonial Williamsburg. You know, I don't know if any of you have been, but it's this very sentimental take on the colonial experience. And not only that, which is ridiculous. And so the first, my joke was like, yes, at 3 o'clock every day, they go out and they whip the slaves. And like, that's what the real, like, so like Colonial Williamsburg experience should be like on repeat. But then I discovered that they actually raised one of the nation's oldest black communities to build this Rockefeller project in the 20s or 30s. And so I was like, okay, these are clearly the people who are going to stage a Julius Eastman memorial dinner as like a dinner theater in Midtown Manhattan. So like, this is this whole framework of the people who I'm being interviewed by. And I'm playing, you know, the artist who's a real big fan, and I'm, you know, I'm like just trying to get my master's degree, and I'm trying to get a word in, and then it's just waves and waves of sort of corporate speak. You know, they're talking to me about beverage sponsors, they're talking to me about Gay Gorilla ringtones, and I'm trying to, you know, hold on to this. He's so wrapped up in, his historicization is so wrapped up into these very urgent identity politics. But then I was also thinking of, like, what does it look like in the expanded view? You know, when identity doesn't matter who you are, it's like we're still sort of deep in this increasingly corporate matrix. And so I wanted to touch on that and also try and invoke humor, as he often did with his titles. You know, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? And while I sort of pitched it perfect, I'm like, this is funny. I wrote a funny script. You know, my Arouge, the vocalist, she's reading it sort of very straight-facedly. It turns out that as we performed it in all different places in the country, like we did it at Red Cat in LA, people got it. They laughed. It was really nice. We did it at the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra space, and it was dead silence the entire time. You know, or there's a, and I was like, this is kind of fascinating. I get this vision of the country as to where these jokes work and don't work. And again, it's trying to think about ways, like I don't want to be, like trying to avoid a sort of sentimental or nostalgia approach, but also not being ironic, but trying to use humor as a juxtaposition towards this a very heavy, very sonic, very wordless experience for the 25-minute piano piece that's in the middle. And so then after that, we play Gay Gorilla, you saw an excerpt, and then finally it ends with me getting the call back from the reporters. And so from the Julie Stiefel Memorial Dinner. And it's the woman who has interviewed me, you'll hear her. And so this is what we play at the end. This is Arouge Aftab.
The Julie Stiefel Memorial Dinner's interview team wants to thank you for taking the time to participate in our hiring process through the phone interview stage. As you can imagine, we received a large number of applications. I am sorry to inform you that you have not been selected for this position. We wish you both personal and professional success in your job search and in the future. We appreciate your interest in our organization. Regards, Arouge Aftab, JEMD Director for the Employee Selection Team. The Julius Eastman Memorial Dinner is an equal opportunity employer. All candidates will be considered regardless of...
And so when I think of the differences, and that's how it ends, it's this kind of, that's the note the piece ends on. But when I think of the differences between now and when I began working with Eastman's work, I think it's the visibility, notoriety, like there are more people playing his work, talking about him now than ever before. It's been a kind of sharp uptick. And so that leaves me with this question of why now? You know, and I like to say, like, there's no... You know, there's no shortage of overlooked geniuses, overlooked, you know. So looking at this person, like, went to school in Philly, died in New York City around 49 or 50, wrote this amazing book. This is Fran Ross, wrote this amazing book in 1974 called Oreo. Black, Jewish, filled with Yiddish, filled with slang, referencing the Theseus mix, like sex jokes, totally irreverent, deeply cerebral, lots of physical comedy, New Directions recently became the third publishing house to put out this book and give her a push and try and get her into the canon, into the discussion. It's crickets, you know, or next to crickets. She wrote this book, nobody cared. She went to write for Richard Pryor for a while for a TV show that failed. You know, so this is like same time period, but then doing a novel. And then there's this person. This is a poem by N.H. Pritchard, or a page from a book of poetry. This is two pages. So again, Lower East Side, New York in the 70s. He wrote two books of poetry, both on Doubleday. The first one came out, zero reviews. I mean, it's fantastic. All of his work, a lot of his work is like this. But so I started thinking, it's like, what is it, you know, literature, poetry, all these, you know, almost like black genius is an overall condition. So what does it mean at this moment now for institutions to be embracing Eastman? Like, what does it mean to have him at the center of a musical narrative? What's going on, you know? And especially when so many other voices are continually forgotten. And so for me, it's, you know, I am very, at the one hand, there is this beautiful shock of recognition and inspiration when I discovered his work and incorporating it into reconfiguring my notion of musical timelines and influence and thinking about the other people, such as these, further on the corners. And that's tampered with a press release I got about 2 days ago for the Unsounds Festival, and they're touting someone as the Polish Julius Eastman. And I was just like, wow, this is nuts. You know, so my question is, it's at a time when many presenting organizations, maybe even more so than Europe, are realizing that they're sort of aging, that their audience isn't as diverse as they'd like, it becomes very easy to look at this person who's been dead a while, reach into the past and say, we are going to embrace the marginal. And it's a very familiar task of institutionalization, this idea of Julius Eastman as a corrective to this historical narrative that they then continue to control. And so I'm interested in what if we look at his very, very beautiful, very fragmented history as something that which was fully intentional, which contains within it the seeds of rebellion, the seeds of question, and, you know, I say reverence as a form of forgetting in the liner notes, and I'm also to the album version of this, which I put out, and I look at his work as a call to conversation. It's a beginning. And, you know, how do you not reify these very kind of basic subject positions of black, gay, New Yorker, whatever, and come up with something much more nuanced and complex? How do you think about responding to works such as Eastman with new questions, with new platforms, new spaces, new ways to clean your clothes late at night?